their mothers and focus on what is good for them and their futures. They work to ensure that the love they feel for their mothers overcomes the rancor they also feel inside. Lands left behind. The exodus of immigrants has been bittersweet for the countries they leave as well. It has provided an escape valve for countries with enormous economic problems, such as Mexico and Honduras. The outflow of workers has kept unemployment from climbing even higher. Immigrants also send huge amounts of money from the United States to their families back home, typically $1 in $10 they make. This brings $30 billion a year to Latin America alone. The cash flow makes up a whopping 15% of El Salvador's gross domestic product and is Mexico's second largest contributor to the economy, after oil. Recipients use money sent back by immigrants for food, clothing, and medical expenses, and to educate children. Grandparents who get money to care for children left behind would be destitute without the payments. Immigrants who return to their home countries also bring skills acquired while living in a more technologically advanced country, says Norberto Giron of the International Organization for Migration in Honduras. They bring lower levels of tolerance for corruption and stronger demands for democratic processes, says Honduran immigration expert Maureen Zamora. Immigrants' desire to communicate with families back home in Honduras has resulted in improved telephone and internet services. But the separation of children and parents has had lasting negative consequences. Huge groups of parentless children have fueled rampant growth in juvenile delinquency and gangs in Honduras, says Glenda Gallardo, principal economist with the United Nations Development Program. If your mom leaves you, if she disappears, it marks you in a way for life, she says. The Mara Salvatrucha, 18th Street, and Mau Mau gangs control whole neighborhoods where they impose a war tax on taxis, bicycles, or buses passing through. A disproportionate number of the 36,000 gangsters in Honduras come from families in which the mother has migrated north, says Zamora. Grandparents, guided by guilt that the child they are raising isn't with his mother, go light on discipline. They also worry that if the child complains and gets moved to another relative, the money the mother sends may go elsewhere as well. A public advertising campaign launched in 2002 is one sign Honduras is facing damage caused by family separations. The advertisements run on television and radio and are plastered on billboards at the Tegucigalpa bus station, where Hondurans head north. "Father, mother," reads an advertisement with a young girl on a swing. "Your children need you. Stay here. In Honduras, there are opportunities to get ahead. Discover them." "We are seeing a disintegration of the family," warns Norberto Giron, the Honduran migration official. "Keeping the family together, even if they are poor, is more important than leaving and improving their economic conditions." Immigrant Nation. Each year, the United States legally admits nearly 1 million people, more than twice as many as in the 1970s. Another 700,000 arrive illegally, up from 200,000 to 300,000 a year in the 1980s and early 1990s. Today, 36 million residents of the United States were born in another country. Nearly a third of those live in the United States illegally. The number of immigrants coming into the country in recent years is the highest ever recorded. And while the proportion of the population that is foreign-born, at 12%, is still lower than the all-time high of 15% in 1890, it has risen from 5% in 1970. More than 6 in 10 residents of Miami and 4 in 10 of Los Angeles are from another country. Some Mexicans and Mexican-Americans have jokingly dubbed the influx La Reconquista, the reconquest of lands once held by Mexico. Enrique and Lourdes disagree about the impact of this on the United States. Enrique says that were he an American citizen, he would want to curtail illegal immigration. Like most on his paint crew, he explains, he gets paid cash under the table and contributes no taxes on what he earns. He uses publicly provided services, including emergency medical care. And he sends a portion of his income to Honduras rather than spending it in his community. Lourdes disagrees. Yes, she says, her daughter was born at a public hospital, and she received welfare for a time. Still, she pays taxes and is entitled to those services. To her, immigrant labor is the engine that helps drive the American economy. Immigrants like herself, she says, work hard at jobs no American wants to do, at least not for minimum wage with no health benefits or paid vacation time. Immigrants' willingness to do certain backbreaking jobs at low wages provides goods and services to all Americans at reasonable prices, she says. Many Americans understand that being born in the United States, with all the opportunities that entails, is a matter of sheer serendipity. They are happy to share a bounty few countries possess. They want the United States to provide desperate people a shot at a better life. Others believe that the wave of immigrants from Latin America is blowback of sorts for U.S. policies. In recent decades, the United States has supported and sometimes even helped install repressive regimes in Latin America. These regimes, they note, propped up economic elites who resisted reforms and perpetuated unequal political and economic systems. This fueled poverty, civil wars, and the resulting economic crisis that is now pushing so many to migrate to the United States. Employers in the United States see other benefits. Enrique's former boss in North Carolina argues that he must pay native-born workers more than immigrants. Yet they work slower, balk at putting in overtime, and don't want to do the hardest jobs. Enrique says native-born painters take a lot of breaks and demand to be paid extra for overtime hours. One of Enrique's co-workers in North Carolina agrees, adding, "Americans say, if they fire me, I can get a better job." The co-worker says that being in the country illegally motivates him to do good work and keep his employment stable. His family in Honduras, he knows, depends on the money he sends. It would be tough to get another job because he is in the country illegally and doesn't speak English. Many experts say immigrants help the economy grow and prevent businesses that rely on cheap labor from being forced to close or go abroad. In some low-education occupations, according to a 1997 study by the National Research Council that is considered among the most comprehensive assessments of the effects of immigration, a quarter to a half of all hours nationwide are worked by immigrant women. Immigrant production of goods and services, the NRC found, added a modest but significant $1.1 billion to $9.5 billion to the nation's $7 trillion economy. American households benefit too. Immigrants lower the cost of nearly 5% of all goods and services that people in U.S. households buy, according to the NRC. That means cheaper food and clothing. Because of immigrants, certain services, child care, gardening, car washing, are within reach of more Americans. Immigrant women who work as nannies and caregivers provide something invaluable: kindness and nurturing, often at the expense of their own children, says Christine M. Zentgroff, a sociology professor at California State University at Long Beach. Immigrants' biggest contribution, others say, is how their presence brings new blood, new ideas, and new ways of looking at things that drive creativity and spur advances. A disproportionate number of the nation's high achievers, the NRC study noted, such as Nobel laureates, are immigrants. Indeed, it is often the most motivated people who are immigrants. Who else would leave everything they know, cross Mexico on top of freight trains, and come to a place where they have to start from scratch? Benefit and burden. Some opposition to immigration is racism, a resistance to change, a discomfort with having people around who don't speak the same language or have similar customs. Yet some of the negative consequences of immigration are real and are becoming increasingly evident as more women and children arrive. Overall, the NRC said immigrants use more government services than the native-born. They have more children, and therefore more youngsters in public schools. This is especially true for immigrants from Latin America, whose households are nearly twice as large as those of the native-born. It will cost the government 2.5 times as much per household to educate their children, the study found. Immigrants are poorer, have lower incomes, and qualify for more state and local services and assistance. Immigrant women receive publicly funded prenatal and obstetric care. Their U.S.-born children are entitled to welfare, food stamps, and Medicaid. Compared to native households, immigrant families from Latin America are nearly 3 times as likely to receive government welfare payments. Because immigrants earn less money and are less likely to own property, they pay lower taxes. Some immigrants receive their salaries in cash and pay no taxes at all. In all, immigrants and their native-born children pay a third less tax per capita than others in the United States, the NRC study found. Households headed by immigrants from Latin America pay half of what natives pay in state and federal taxes. The fiscal burden to taxpayers is greatest in immigrant-heavy states, such as California, where an estimated 1 in 4 illegal immigrants live, and where half of all children have immigrant parents. Local and state governments shoulder the biggest cost generated by immigrants. Public education. An average non-immigrant household in California paid $1,178 more in state and local taxes than the value of the services they received. Conversely, immigrant households paid $3,463 less than the value of the services they received, the NRC found. The crush of immigrants has hastened the deterioration of many public services, namely schools, hospitals, and state jails and prisons. Classrooms are crowded. Hospital emergency rooms have been forced to close, in part because so many poor, uninsured, non-paying patients, including immigrants, are provided with free mandated care. In Los Angeles County, jails have had to release prisoners early because of overcrowding caused in part by criminal immigrants. A 2001 University of Arizona study found that in the 28 southwestern border counties of Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Texas, the cost of arresting, prosecuting, and jailing illegal immigrants who commit crimes amounted to as much as $125 million per year. The Center for Immigration Studies, which seeks reduced immigration levels, found that in 2002, nationwide, households headed by illegal immigrants used $26.3 billion in government services and paid $16 billion in taxes. Those hardest hit by the influx of immigrants are disadvantaged native-born minorities who don't have a high school degree, namely African Americans and previous waves of Latino immigrants. They must compete for the same low-end jobs immigrants take. Wages for high school dropouts, who make up 1 in 14 native workers, have dropped in recent years. Between 1980 and 2000, a Harvard University study found the influx of immigrant workers to the United States cut wages for native workers with no high school diploma by 7.4%, or $1,800 on an average salary of $25,000. Sometimes whole industries switch from native to immigrant workers. In 1993, I looked at efforts to unionize Latino janitors in Los Angeles. Previously, the jobs had been largely held by African Americans, who had succeeded in obtaining increased wages and health benefits. Cleaning companies busted their union, then brought in Latino immigrant workers at half the wages and no benefits. In 1996, I went to an ordinary block of two-bedroom homes in East Los Angeles to understand why nearly a third of California Latinos had supported Proposition 187, a voter initiative to bar illegal immigrants from schools, hospitals, and most public assistance. The measure passed and was later struck down by the courts. For residents of the block, support for Prop 187 wasn't a nativist reaction or scapegoating in tight economic times. They said ill feelings toward illegal immigrants were grounded in how the newcomers had affected their neighborhood and their lives. For them, the influx had meant not cut-rate nannies and gardeners, but heightened job competition, depressed wages, overcrowded government services, and a reduced quality of life. The newcomers who moved into the neighborhood were poor. Residents estimated that the block's population had tripled since 1970. Up to 17 immigrants were jammed into one small stucco house. Some lived in garages without plumbing, using lawns to relieve themselves. The second and third generation Latinos on the block felt it was their working class neighborhoods that bore the brunt of a wave of impoverished, unskilled workers. Immigrants were arriving at an unsettling pace, crowding them out of jobs and lowering wages. Immigrants weren't just taking jobs natives didn't covet. They competed for work as painters, mechanics, and construction workers. In the 1980s, the Rand Corporation, a Santa Monica think tank, found that the benefits of immigration outweighed the costs. By 1997, they had reversed course. The economy wasn't producing new jobs for high school dropouts, an increasing proportion of whom, roughly half, were unemployed. Rand said some native adults had become unemployed because of immigrant competition. They recommended the country slash legal immigration to 1970s levels. Some immigration experts question whether it makes sense to allow so many immigrants with low levels of education from poor, underdeveloped countries, when the United States needs to compete globally in industries requiring high levels of education, creativity, and know-how. Mexican immigrants arrive with an average of 5 to 9 years of education. Other experts focus on how adding more than 1 million immigrants a year to the United States population affects overcrowding of parks, freeways, and the environment. Immigration accounted for more than half of the 33 million new U.S. residents in the 1990s. With nearly 300 million people, the United States has almost five times as many residents as when Ellis Island welcomed new arrivals. In Los Angeles County, the surge in immigrants helped cause the poverty rate to nearly double to 25% between 1980 and 1997. The effect, at least in the short term, a sea of poor and working-class neighborhoods amid islands of affluence. Schizophrenic policies. In the end, any calculus of the benefits and burdens of immigration depends on who you are. People who own businesses and commercial interests that use cheap immigrant labor benefit the most from immigrants like Enrique and Lourdes. They get a ready supply of compliant, low-cost workers. Other winners are couples who hire immigrants to care for their children and drive them to school, tend to their lawns, clean their houses, and wash their cars. High school dropouts have the most to lose. So do residents of immigrant-heavy states such as California, where an estimated third of illegal immigrants live, because services immigrants use disproportionately, such as public schools, are funded with local and state taxes, Polls show Americans in recent years have hardened their views of immigrants, particularly those who are in the country illegally. A growing proportion, 2/3, compared with half in the mid-1970s, thinks the government should reduce immigration from current levels. Many immigration observers believe U.S. officials have pursued a purposefully schizophrenic immigration policy. The government has added Border Patrol agents along the nation's southwestern border and walled off 76 miles of that divide. Politicians talk tough about catching illegal immigrants. Meanwhile, critics say efforts to enforce many of the nation's immigration laws are weak to non-existent. Labor-intensive industries, agriculture, construction, food processing, restaurants, domestic help agencies, want cheap immigrant labor to bolster their bottom lines. Whenever immigration authorities make even cursory attempts to enforce a 1986 law that allows employers to be fined up to $10,000 for each illegal immigrant they hire, businesses, onion farmers in Georgia, meatpacking firms in the Midwest, bitterly complain. Fines on businesses and raids by immigration enforcement agents have gone from sporadic to virtually nil. Similarly, a pilot project allowing some employers to check the immigration status of job applicants via telephone has never expanded nationally and remains voluntary. In essence, politicians have put a lock on the front door while swinging the back door wide open. A crackdown on the U.S.-Mexico border, begun in 1993, was designed to shift immigrant traffic to more remote parts of the border, where Border Patrol agents have a tactical advantage. Since the buildup began, the number of agents patrolling the border and the amount of money spent on enforcement have both tripled, according to a 2002 study by the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC. Yet there is no evidence, the PPIC concluded, that the strategy has worked. In fact, the number of immigrants in the United States illegally has grown more quickly since the border buildup began. Many outcomes of the new strategy have been unintended and negative, the PPIC says. More illegal immigrants now use smugglers, 89%, compared to 70% before. Immigrants, particularly those from Mexico, once returned home after brief work stints in the United States. Today, the increasing difficulty and cost of crossing means more come and stay. The new strategy has also resulted in more than 300 deaths each year, as migrants are forced to cross in areas that are less populated, more isolated, and more geographically hostile. Some priests in Mexico, whose churches are located near the rails, are so sure the flow of Central American migrants will be never-ending that they have recently built their own migrant shelters. As long as the grinding poverty such as Enrique's mother lived in exists, priests in these churches believe people will try to get to the United States, even if they must take enormous risks to get there. In the United States, many immigration experts have concluded that the only effective strategy for change is to bolster the economies of immigrant-sending countries. Hondurans point out a few things that would help bring that about. Forgiving foreign debt would allow more of their country's resources to go into development. Implementing U.S. trade policies that give a strong preference to goods from immigrant-sending countries would help spur growth in certain industries, such as textiles, that employ women in Honduras. Others believe the United States, notoriously stingy among industrialized nations in per capita gifts of foreign aid, should boost donations. Individuals, Hondurans note, can support non-governmental organizations that encourage job-creating small businesses or improve the availability of education in Honduras, where 12% of children never attend a school. Most immigrants would rather stay in their home countries with their extended families. Who wants to leave home and everything he or she knows for something foreign, not knowing if he or she will ever return? Not many. What would ensure that more women can stay home with their children where they want to be? Maria Isabel's mother, Eva, says simply, "What would it take to keep people from leaving? There would have to be jobs. Jobs that pay okay. That's all."
Epilogue. Two Promises. When Enrique first arrives in the United States, he promises himself two things: to leave drugs behind and to bring his daughter north quickly. 6 months after Maria Isabel arrives in North Carolina, Jasmin journeys north. The four-year-old girl travels with a trusted female smuggler. She crosses a river on a suspension bridge and is stashed away in the back of an 18-wheeler truck. Jasmin crosses the Rio Grande on an inflated inner tube, just like her father. She is caught by Border Patrol agents as she is entering the United States, but as a minor is quickly released to her parents, with an order to appear in immigration court at a later date. Jasmin runs toward her mother when she sees her. "Mommy," she cries. Maria Isabel sobs and embraces her. But Jasmin, a girl with crooked teeth, curly hair, and a big smile, keeps her distance from Enrique. "He is your father," Maria Isabel insists. Enrique bridges the divide by spoiling his daughter. On weekends, when Maria Isabel is cleaning hotel rooms, Enrique takes Jasmin to the Golden Corral, or McDonald's, or to the mall to buy clothes. He watches SpongeBob SquarePants and iCarly with her. With each day, Jasmin grows closer to her father. "You're my girl," Enrique says lovingly. Enrique and Maria Isabel are fearful of Jasmin being deported, and the girl learns to ride behind cars when she is on the street and sees immigration agents. In Florida, Jasmin becomes inseparable from her grandmother Lourdes. They spend so much time together, people assume Jasmin is Lourdes's daughter. They dress alike, wear their curly dark hair up in high ponytails, wear dangly earrings. Lourdes heaps so much love and attention on the girl that Diana gets jealous. "Everything I lost with Enrique, I am enjoying with her. Her childhood," Lourdes says. A Lawless Land. When Enrique moves his family to Florida, he rents in the same apartment complex as his mother. The gray apartments, built of cinder blocks, have large balconies in front of the second-floor apartments. On Friday and Saturday nights, many Latino men, their work week done, gather on the balconies to sip beer and talk. Most are not in the United States legally, so they don't have bank accounts. They carry wads of bills from paychecks they received and cashed that day. To a group of African-American gangsters at the complex, the cash and the men's unwillingness to go to police to report crimes for fear of being deported make them ideal targets. One Sunday evening in December 2006, Enrique and three friends are sipping Coronas outside after the week's work painting houses. Enrique descends the stairs to his friend's balcony to take a call on his cell phone. Two attractive African-American women brush past him going up the stairs. They stop to flirt with his friends. Distracted, Enrique's friends don't notice a car with three African-American men that pulls up in front of their apartment. The gangsters jump out of their car and run up the stairs to the balcony. Enrique, determined to help his friends, turns to follow the men up the stairs. One of the gangsters, brandishing a gun, grabs Enrique and flings him over the railing. Enrique crumples to the ground. He gets up and runs. Two friends follow. Only one friend remains on the balcony. The gangsters demand that he hand over his cell, a gold chain he is wearing, and his wallet, which contains just $30. They order him to unlock his apartment door. Enrique's friend refuses. The gangsters punch him in the stomach. They grab his throat. They slam the back of his head. Finally, one of the gangsters swings a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun at his face. The blow splits open his forehead. He staggers, then falls to the ground. Conscious, he lies still as a stone, holding his breath, pretending he is dead, afraid the gangsters will finish him off. Blood streams from his head. "He's dead," he hears one of the women say. The women and gangsters flee. 16 stitches in his head save Enrique's friend. But the robbery is the beginning of constant fear for Enrique and his family. For the next month, gangsters arrive at both Enrique's and his friend's apartment doors at 2 a.m. They knock loudly. "Police, let us in." Enrique peers out the peephole. It is not the police. One day, as he is sitting outside on a bench near the apartment playground, someone shoots at Enrique. Another night, someone rams into the front of his Toyota in the apartment parking lot, causing $2,000 worth of damage. Enrique and Lourdes believe the gangsters want to intimidate him so he does not report what he witnessed about the beating to police. "They wanted us to be afraid," Lourdes says. A month after Enrique's friend is pummeled and robbed, the same gangsters beat and rob a Mexican man who lives in the apartment directly below Lourdes's. Drunk and enraged, the Mexican man runs into his apartment, grabs his machete, and chases the three gangsters. As he closes in on the gangsters, one of them turns around and shoots the Mexican man three times. The man in his 20s falls to the ground, dead. In the spring of 2007, Lourdes's boyfriend finds that the three vans he uses for his house painting business have been broken into. He loses $13,000 worth of tools, including two new sprayers and a compressor. Latinos in the apartment complex start buying guns, fearful that gangsters might come into their apartments and kill their families. They stop sitting outside on benches by the playground, even during daylight. Lourdes's and Enrique's families don't go out at night, always keep their doors locked, and look through the peephole before opening the front door. "It is like we are dogs locked up in a cage," Lourdes says. "We have so much fear." Police step up patrols and yet never seem to be around when bad things happen. And as far as Enrique's family can tell, the beating of Enrique's friend, the murder of the Mexican, and the van break-ins all go unsolved. Enrique never reports any crime against him to authorities. Like most immigrants in the United States illegally, he fears that calling the cops will lead to deportation. Worse, Lourdes fears that because she went on Don Francisco's television show without disguising herself, and because many in the neighborhood have tied her to a best-selling book about undocumented immigrants, her family's odds of being deported are potentially higher. Instead of turning to police, Enrique and Lourdes opt to move. A bad move. In North Carolina, Enrique gave up glue sniffing, but in Florida he meets new friends who use different drugs. His troubles with alcohol and prescription drugs come and go. He is usually a doting father and husband, a son who hugs his mother every morning and tells her he loves her. But there are times when Lourdes doesn't recognize her son. There are moments when Maria Isabel, who has become less shy and timid under Lourdes's tutelage, packs all of Enrique's clothing into garbage bags and tells him to get out. Sometimes he knocks on his mother's door in the middle of the night asking for money. At times he fails to pay the rent and even pawns the gold jewelry he bought himself, and then bracelets, chains, and rings he bought for Maria Isabel and Jasmine. "Mom, why are my dad's eyes like this?" Jasmine asks her mother. The girl asks Enrique, "Papi, why do you spend all of your time out in the street?" Enrique doesn't answer. Instead, he is so depressed, he thinks of killing himself or running away. But when Maria Isabel tells him to leave, Enrique appeals to his daughter for help. Hasmin turns to Maria Isabel and pleads, "Mom, why are you asking my dad to leave?" When Maria Isabel met Enrique, she was shy and giggled constantly. Now she cries, a powerful mourning that comes from deep hurt he has caused. In 2010, Lourdes convinces Enrique and his family to move back in with her. Her presence, she hopes, will help her son. Also, Enrique can help her cover her rent. Ever since the real estate bubble burst in 2007, which hit Florida particularly hard, Lourdes and her longtime boyfriend have struggled financially. Lourdes's boyfriend has to let go his crew of 20 painters. He begins working for an hourly rate. If there is no work locally, he roams from Georgia to Key West for jobs. Lourdes helps keep the family afloat by caring for two elderly Floridian siblings. When Lourdes goes out on an errand, she invites Enrique to come along. There alone, she talks to him. "You must change," she tells him. "What kind of role model are you providing for your daughter? Have you ever seen me drunk or on drugs? You should cherish Maria Isabel, who has stayed with you for the sake of your daughter. You will never find a woman like this again," Lourdes tells Enrique. "Don't be a coward. Don't let drugs dominate you." Enrique used to shut down any conversation like this, wouldn't let his mother get a word in about his problems. Or he'd berate her, saying he never would have started sniffing glue if she hadn't left him. If she had always been there to discipline him, he would have been a good son. Now he listens and cries. "Sí, ma, yo sé." "Yes, Mom, I know," Enrique murmurs. "Es que no puedo." "It's hard. I can't." "Sí puedes," Lourdes answers. Ever since arriving in the United States, she has told herself she is a strong person, free of fear. "I thought I could do anything," Lourdes says. Now she turns to God for help. She joins an evangelical church and takes 3 years of courses that allow her to become an intercedora, a leader that can put hands on people and pray for them. In April 2010, Lourdes marries her boyfriend in keeping with the teachings of the church. Her daughter Belki follows in her footsteps, joining an evangelical church in Honduras and marrying her longtime boyfriend, Giovanni, the same month. For Lourdes, faith helps her manage disappointment. "Since I came from Honduras, all I wanted was to have my children study, be well raised," Lourdes says. Belki never finishes college. She makes and sells fruit pops. Diana drops out of high school half a credit short of finishing. She talks of being a police officer, but instead goes to work selling telephone plans for $9.50 an hour. A fateful robbery. In 2010, Diana and Hasmin sit behind the glass counter of the telephone store where Diana works. Business is slow. They are watching a movie. A man walks in and asks Diana about the company's prepaid telephone plans. Suddenly, he whips out a gun. He points it at Hasmin and Diana's faces. Hasmin, 9, starts crying. So does Diana. The man tells them he doesn't want to rob them, but he needs cash to flee the police and get out of town. Diana tells him to turn to God for help. He starts crying and demands Diana empty the cash register. When the man runs out of the store, Diana dials the police and tells Hasmin to run outside and describe the man's getaway car. Moments later, using the information Hasmin provided, the police catch the robber, who has a long rap sheet. 2 years later, that random robbery is what may save her own father from harm. Maria Isabel's vow. Lourdes has always stood by Enrique no matter what. She feels her love has moderated his worst behavior. She vows that she abandoned him once but will never do it again. She has promised herself to be a loving mother, the opposite of her own stepfather, who inflicted physical abuse on Lourdes as a child. In 2011, Lourdes devises another plan to set her son right for good. Maria Isabel has turned 30, and although Jasmine desperately wants a sister, Maria Isabel refuses. How could she afford a babysitter, which cost $100 a week, when she works furiously every day cleaning 20 rooms at a local hotel, but after 5 years only makes $8.40 an hour? The recession means empty hotel rooms, and sometimes she doesn't get a full 8-hour day. A babysitter would consume nearly half of her take-home pay. Besides, Enrique sometimes uses his paycheck to go out carousing at night. Lourdes tells Maria Isabel one thing will transform Enrique. Give him a son. Maria Isabel doesn't buy this. He hasn't changed for Jasmine, has he? But in October 2011, when she runs out of birth control pills, she doesn't go buy more for 5 days. She has heard erroneously that if you have been on the pill a long time, you won't get pregnant. A gift. On Christmas Eve, Enrique is nowhere to be found. Lourdes, furious, has a talk with Maria Isabel. We have to cut him loose. He finally comes home the day after Christmas at 3 a.m. He knocks hard on his mother's bedroom door. He wants $20. You know I don't have cash, she says from bed. Enrique persists. Lourdes's husband finally gives him $20 so he can go back to sleep. Lourdes, wide awake, talks to God and asks for something unthinkable to her before. If this is the life he is going to lead, please take him away from me, she says. Enrique's future, she tells God, is out of her hands. She won't ask God to help him anymore. She tells the devil she will no longer give him the satisfaction of seeing her shed another tear over her son. Exhausted, Lourdes falls asleep. She has a dream. She is wandering, searching for some place with Enrique cradled in her arms. A woman and two men offer to help. Then they start laughing at her naivete. Does she really think we will help her? They morph into Satan. They start battling her, and Lourdes prays to God to help her. The strongest of the three approaches Lourdes. I will destroy you, he says. Lourdes laughs, strong in her faith. But then Satan picks up something that terrifies Lourdes, a serpent. He presses the head of the snake to her face as its long, cold body drapes down next to hers. Lourdes summons all her strength, squeezes the serpent, and throws it to the ground. It explodes. The three Satans dissolve. Lourdes awakes at dawn covered in sweat, her legs so weak they wobble. She slides down to the floor, to her knees, and prays. She vows to God she will never again ask him for anything for her son. Enrique has spent the night drinking with friends at a run-down brick motel, with brown shutters and plywood patches on some of the doors. He returns home late in the afternoon, not having slept in 3 days. Enrique goes into his mother's bedroom. Lourdes has left her wedding ring on the dresser, a gold band with one square diamond. Enrique grabs it. He tells himself he will pawn it and get it back with his next paycheck. At 8 p.m. that night, Jacksonville sheriffs arrive at the motel where Enrique and four others are in a room drinking. Sheriffs discover Enrique has an outstanding order of arrest for not paying a ticket 3 years before for driving without a license, a traffic violation. As part of the wave of local and state anti-illegal immigrant laws passed in recent years, most states no longer allow undocumented migrants to get driver's licenses. He spends the night in jail, expecting to be arrested. When Maria Isabel, 3 months pregnant, learns of his arrest, she cries hysterically. Locked up. In 2008, the federal government began rolling out a program every police department in the country had to implement by 2013. If someone is arrested for any reason, their fingerprints must be sent to federal immigration authorities, who will deport people who are in the United States illegally. As the federal program was adopted by thousands of police departments, Deportations increased 40% between 2006 and 2011, a year when the United States deported more than 400,000 immigrants nationwide. During those same 5 years, Florida nearly doubled the number of undocumented immigrants it had in its jails any given night. Increasingly, families like Enrique's are being separated again, this time in reverse. Parents are being deported back to Central America, away from their U.S.-born children. About 200,000 parents of U.S. citizen children were deported between 2010 and 2012, and 5,000 parentless children are in foster care because their mother or father was detained or deported. The increased deportations put Enrique's family and migrants around the country in a state of constant fear. Hasmin, a girl who loves Justin Bieber, puppies, and dolphins, and dons a reflective belt to man her post every weekday as the student safety officer at her elementary school, is afraid each morning when her mother walks out the door to go to the grocery store or on an errand. "I worry," the girl says, "about my mom being deported." The day after Enrique's arrest, sheriffs hand him over to immigration authorities who place him at Baker County Detention Center in McClenny, Florida, and begin deportation proceedings. Baker County sets aside one of its two wings just for immigrant detainees. The county receives nearly $85 per day from the government to hold immigrants, an average of $21,264 per night in fiscal 2011. The immigrant wing has 8 locked areas, each with a high-ceilinged common area and 2 stories of cells along the perimeter. The inside of the jail is stark. The walls are cinder blocks painted eggshell. The floor is gray concrete. At night, immigrants are locked into their cells, which sleep 2 or 4 detainees. Enrique tries to sleep atop the thin brown mattress on the narrow steel bunk bolted to the wall of his cell. The TV blares until midnight. Metal doors clang open and shut all night. Earplugs are prohibited. He cannot sleep. Purple rings circle his eyes. County inmates are offered GED classes and Alcoholics Anonymous sessions. Immigrants are not. A cart arrives, but Enrique sees only books in English, Russian, and French. Enrique understands everything the guards say and speaks passable English but cannot read it. During the day, he is allowed out of his cell into a common area, which has 4 stainless steel picnic tables and 1 TV. English and Spanish language-speaking migrants fight over what channel to tune into. Federal detention standards entitle immigration inmates to an hour of outdoor recreation. Jails lacking an outdoor area can substitute a large recreation room with free-flowing air and natural light. In Enrique's jail, the recreation room has 1 ping-pong table and 2 Y-screens for more than 240 inmates. Air and light come from 1 window at the top of the 2-story room. The only time Enrique feels sunlight on his face is when he has a dental emergency. He can petition after 6 months to move to a jail with an outdoor area, but it would take him away from his family. Instead, he paces, does push-ups, or plays chess because it takes a long time to finish a game. At night, he reads a Bible a prison chaplain gave him. The only break from the monotony is when visitors arrive. Enrique cannot see them in person or even through plexiglass. He must view them on 1 of 2 video screens in the prisoner's common area right outside his cell. A journalist's decision. Lourdes looks for help. In January 2012, she calls me. Enrique is locked up, she says, and she must find a lawyer. Journalists usually don't get involved personally with people they write about, because we must convey reality to readers, not write about a reality we have altered. Our credibility depends on playing it straight with readers, on not taking sides, There is a clear exception to the no involvement rule. If someone is in imminent danger, we should help them, if we can, and then we must disclose what we have done to readers. I had followed how increasingly dangerous Honduras has become. The country now has the highest homicide rate in the world, according to the United Nations. Large swaths of Honduras, including Enrique's family neighborhood, have fallen under the control of gangs like the Zetas, Mexico's most violent narco-trafficking organization, as they fight for territory to move drugs to the world's largest consumer, the United States. The Zetas and other gangs impose an impuesto de guerra, a war tax on bus drivers and business owners. At the taxi stand near Enrique's neighborhood, the Zetas enforcer shows up every morning with a checklist of drivers. Anyone who hasn't paid the daily $13 tax is threatened or killed. No one calls police, who are widely viewed as in league with the shakedowns. Belky marvels that in just one weekend, 38 people were murdered in Tegucigalpa, a city of 1.1 million. Relatives can't afford a box or burial, so the government puts victims into mass graves. I learned that 4 of Enrique's close family members were getting texts and telephone calls with death and extortion threats. The family changed phone numbers and stopped going out at night. My book has made Enrique famous in his neighborhood and in Honduras, where 3 prominent TV shows about the book have been widely viewed. When Belky went to the U.S. Embassy to request a visa to visit the United States again, the official told her, "You are the famous one, the one on TV." To instill fear and earn greater notoriety, gangs in Honduras target and kill famous people. They had already murdered a previous president's son and a well-known journalist. "If Enrique comes back, he is going to die," Belky told me. I contacted several lawyers in Florida to help Enrique. His story had inspired changes in laws in Mexico and prompted readers to build schools, water systems, and help establish job-generating businesses in Central America and in Mexico. Every day, readers emailed that the book had changed their views by broadening their perspective and educating them about the migrants in our midst. I asked lawyers, would they help? 2 married Miami attorneys, Sui Chung at Immigration Law and Litigation Group, and Professor Michael S. Vasteen, director of the Immigration Law Clinic at St. Thomas University School of Law, stepped forward. Chung, the daughter of South Korean immigrants and a passionate advocate for human rights, had launched a project in South Florida to represent mentally incompetent immigrants facing deportation. Like all unlawful immigrants, the mentally ill aren't entitled to a government attorney, even though some face danger when they are deported home. Chung takes on half our cases for free. The 2 lawyers would pour more than $100,000 in billable hours into Enrique's case for free, and pursued 2 legal strategies: that either a past trauma or a future one he might face should save Enrique from deportation. They claimed the U.S. government should allow Enrique to stay in the United States by awarding him political asylum because his notoriety would make him the target of the Zetas in Honduras. Some immigration judges deny 90% of asylum claims. Others approve the same percentage. Enrique's judge, James Grimm, has a higher than average denial rate, 77%. A son. On July 2, 2012, Maria Isabel goes into labor. Enrique, awaiting the outcome of his asylum claim, has been locked up for 6 months. He is in jail 35 miles away. When the contractions intensify, Maria Isabel grabs Lourdes's left forearm and digs her nails in, trying to cope with the pain. Lourdes tells her she can give birth without an epidural to be strong. Daniel Enrique is born at 5:38 the next morning. His head emerges with the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck. He is purple from lack of oxygen. But he is a fighter. He draws in a big breath and then puts his thumb into his mouth, hungry. Enrique has now missed the birth of both of his children. When he hears about his son's birth, Enrique momentarily considers signing papers to be deported to Honduras, despite the risk of being killed there. He feels frustrated hearing that friends and relatives who were deported are back in the United States in just 1 or 2 months. Enrique feels so stressed and depressed, he cannot sleep. They put him in solitary confinement, a cell with a camera for overnight observation. He complains, and they put him on an antidepressant. Lourdes talks sense back into her son, urging him to think about all the time his attorneys have put into his case. She tells him he will be targeted and killed in Honduras. She reminds him that any journey north will be more dangerous than ever. In 2011, prodded by human rights activists and accounts such as Enrique's journey, Mexico passes a law allowing Central Americans to transit legally through their country. But the good done by that law is canceled out by the CETA's seizing control of the central train route Enrique once took. People pretending to be smugglers turn migrants over to the narco-trafficking cartel. The CETAs beat and torture people to obtain information about relatives in the United States and demand ransom from them. They especially target children, because they are most likely to have relatives willing to do anything to piece together the ransom required for their release. In 2010, an 18-year-old relative of Enrique's set off for the United States and disappeared. In 2012, a 16-year-old who left from Enrique's neighborhood was kidnapped in Mexico and tortured. In a 2012 report, Human Rights Watch said that about 18,000 Central American migrants were being kidnapped each year crossing into Mexico. Those who don't have money are killed. Enrique's cousin, who made the journey in 2012, estimates that a third of migrants get kidnapped. If Enrique gets deported, returns to the United States, and again gets caught by police, the consequences could be severe. His attorneys have seen clients with no criminal history get 8 years in jail for re-entering the United States without permission. Enrique, who still has a scar and bump on his forehead from his journey in 2000, decides to stay put. On July 8, 2012, 5 days after the birth of his son, Enrique calls me collect. He thanks me for my help. Enrique acknowledges his troubled past, but argues that everyone should have a chance at redemption. We should all have a chance to change. He says he wants to focus on his children, his wife, his mother, and himself. I want to do something with my life. 11 days after Danielle's birth, Judge Grimm denies Enrique's claim to political asylum on all counts. Grimm says he doesn't find Enrique credible because of inconsistencies in his stated drug use. Enrique, the judge says, is afraid simply because gangs want to extort money from him like they do everyone else. Grimm says Enrique is in danger going back to Honduras, but hasn't met specific criteria for asylum, proving he is part of a persecuted group. On July 19, 2012, he orders Enrique deported. Enrique watches the judge rule from a video camera at Baker County Detention Center. It is one of the worst moments of his life. The next month, his attorneys appeal. Michael Vasteen, an expert on migrants with drug convictions, believes Enrique's life shouldn't be endangered because he had a 2005 conviction for being caught with a small amount of marijuana and cocaine residue, a felony. In 2000, the U.S. Congress created a U visa that allows migrants to stay legally in the United States if they are victims of a crime, provided that they report that crime and then help prosecute the perpetrator by serving as witnesses. Congress envisioned the U visa as an invaluable tool to encourage migrants frightened of coming forward and cooperating with police, because doing so could result in deportation or retaliation.